Beyond the darkness, beyond the human evolution, is Khan, a genetically superior tyrant. Exiled to a barren planet, banished by a starship commander he is destined to destroy. Left for dead, he has survived.
Chase him round the moons of Nibia and round the Antares maelstrom and round perdition's flames before I give him up. There she is! There she is!
Captain. Can you evade their power?
A few shots, sir.
Not enough against their shields.
The base is starboard.
Scotty, I need warp speed in 3 minutes or we're all dead.
I've done far worse than kill you. I've hurt you. And I wish to go on hurting you. I shall leave you as you left me, marooned for all eternity, buried alive,
Khan! Khan!
At the end of the universe lies the beginning of vengeance. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Opens at a theater near you, June 4th.
Good afternoon, folks, and welcome to the Nerd Orchestra Podcast. This is the podcast where we review orchestral movie soundtracks for genre movies. By that, I mean superhero movies, science fiction, horror, and action movies. Movies where the soundtrack is a definite part of the proceedings, without which the movie would not be the same. My name is Chuck Dill, and I'm one of your hosts for this podcast. I grew up in the 1970s, loving comic books and all sorts of genre movies. I sat in the theater in the summer of 77, watching Star Wars at almost 8 years old, and letting that soundtrack fill up my chest and be in my head for 2 hours. I wanted to hold that feeling in and never let it go. And that leads us to here, where we can sit down and talk about the soundtracks that we love. I have no musical education. I'm not trained in music. I don't play an instrument. I can't even sing. My only pedigree is an addiction to orchestral movie soundtracks going back to the late 1970s. But fortunately, I'm joined by my more than qualified co-host in this endeavor, Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob and returning guest star Dr. Husband join us from the world-famous Checkered podcast, where they review DC Comics of the 1960s.
That's Checkered Past podcast.
Uh-oh.
It's okay. You're a devotee of our and frequent guest.
I'm your biggest fan.
You are our biggest fan,
I think.
Yeah.
My name is Dr. Bob. I also grew up in the 1970s. I also love comic books and superheroes, but I also hate money, so I got a terminal degree in music performance.
And I'm Dr. Husband. I also grew up in the 1970s, though I am a little bit, just a couple years younger than these two fellas here at the table. I saw Star Wars in a drive-in theater in Miami.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
And let's see. I also am a musician, and I'm really excited to be here. Yeah.
Were you sitting on top of the car?
I was actually probably watching it on the playground.
No.
Yeah. I mean, my parents just... 1970s, you just take your kids to the drive-in theater, open the doors, and tell them to get out.
You know? Absolutely.
If we were making noise, they said, get out. You know, here's some bug spray. Get out. Here's a couple bucks. Here's a couple bucks. Go. Yeah. So, yeah, we might have been laying on top of the car.
Yeah. So today we'll be talking about one of my absolute favorite movies, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Something that has embedded itself in our current culture with memes and Kirk screaming the word Khan at the screen. And it's just such an awesome movie from beginning to end. We assembled for it in 1984 for one of my birthday parties. Three gentlemen, which I had unfortunately labeled as friends, reluctantly agreed to come to my house. And one of them started an argument about who the true star of Star Trek was, and that it was the Enterprise.
Are we friends with your friends who came to that?
No.
Wow, how is that possible? I mean, I would think we'd still be friends with them. It sounds like any one of our friends.
That's true.
The true star of Star Trek is not Captain. No. It is not Spock. It is not Uhura. And it definitely is not Scotty. It is the Enterprise herself.
Right, that's exactly how
it is. And all the joy she contains within.
That's what, yes. And one of my friends stumbled when he said, he said, you should fire the photon torpedoes, but instead he said four-ton potatoes.
Kinder's so dumb.
We got a lot of mileage out of that.
Well, honestly, if you had enough velocity built up, a four-ton potato would do a lot of damage.
Yeah,
sure.
To a Klingon ship. Mm-hmm. I saw Star Trek II in the theater with my older sister, who you would not peg as a science fiction fan. But indeed, she took me to the theater to see it because she was all into Ricardo Montalban.
Oh.
And I had seen that episode of Star Trek, but I really didn't remember who Khan was at the time.
Yeah. Mm-mm.
Well, I saw it with my mom, I think, or maybe my best friend, Ryder. I'm not sure.
Yes.
I'm not sure who I saw it with. I would have been, if it was 1984, I would have been 13.
No, the movie came out in 82.
Oh, 82. Well, then I would have been 11. So I probably saw it when I was 11 or 12, which was a very, very difficult time in my life. So I can't be sure that I actually saw it in the theater when it came out. I might have seen it in one of the second run theaters.
Gotcha.
Yeah, at the Daytona Mall or something like
that.
Yes.
We came out when my family lived in Montgomery, Alabama. We lived there for less than a year. I didn't have many friends. It was sixth grade. But I remember sitting in the theater. I was terrified of the scene where Chekhov gets the earworm.
Yes.
I remember that being the scariest thing I'd ever seen in my life. And at the end, Spock dying... I was brought to tears as a child, but in my family, men did not cry.
Of course not.
So I sat there and had to concentrate on my popcorn bag and do everything I could to try to rein it in before my parents caught wind of the fact that I was crying about a science fiction character dying in a Star Trek movie.
Oh.
Found out later that my mother also got a little choked up.
Yeah.
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 I was too worried about not getting caught to
isn't that
to
funny how that was? I mean, you should have been able to just cry.
Now and I openly sob like a baby.
Well, yeah, now you do. Now, that's after you're scarred for so long, but it would have been nice to have just had your mom or even your dad say, oh, that really affected you, didn't it? It's a good movie, huh? And let you cry, No, of course not.
Did you cry more for Spock or for Tony Stark?
Spock.
Okay.
Tony Stark, when he died as Iron Man?
Yeah.
Oh, hell. What? Spock. 100%.
Well, I don't know what theater you were in. Me and the guy next to me at the Avengers Endgame, whom I didn't know, were both ugly crying. I'm surprised we didn't just hold each other.
I don't even remember that movie.
What?
I don't know. Maybe I was in a diabetic coma.
So, Star Trek II was one of my favorite movies, and we had already established last episode that I did not really buy the cassettes. I didn't know that was a thing you could do. So this is another movie that I taped off of the TV so I could listen to the music later. I even taped the main battle scene between the Enterprise and the Reliant. And so I've got that dialogue memorized, as I subjected you to when we watched it together. But then years afterwards, towards the late 80s and into the 90s, I kept searching for the soundtrack and could never find it. It was never in any music stores or CD stores or whatever. I eventually got my hands on a catalog of old science fiction soundtracks and tapes and ordered it and finally got it on cassette tape that way.
Did you order it from the Record of the Month
Columbia
Club?
House.
Columbia House?
No. It was
Cassette of the Month Club? No.
Columbia House was for mainstream people that could be like
friends.
Normal. Yeah.
So James Horner, 1953 to 2015, I had no idea he was so prolific.
Me neither. I am embarrassed. I had no idea. You obviously, Chuck, you do know what scores are associated with what composers, especially if they're well known. We don't pay attention to that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, you know John Williams, Danny Elfman.
Yeah.
I'm starting to look for it. And in the 80s, I knew James Horner from Star Trek II and Star Trek III.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Another fantastic soundtrack. So I started to look for other pieces of his work because the Star Trek II soundtrack gave me such a thrill, I wanted more of that.
Yeah.
But that's more about the orchestral work to the movie. So when I picked up the soundtrack to Glory, the Denzel Washington Civil War soundtrack, there wasn't anything in there like that with the battle between the Enterprise and the Reliant. Just a completely different flow. It took me a while to figure it's not like a rock star where a lot of their music is going to be similar to other music.
Yeah.
Orchestral composers, they've got to match the movie that they're composing.
Well, that's funny that you say that because he gets a lot of heat for like stealing from himself.
Yes.
Particularly with Star Trek II, but kind of across the board, he has a reputation for just reusing old material.
So he did like 198 movies, I think. Where he has 198 different credits.
Wow.
Well, I found a quote from him addressing this controversy.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
He said, unlike anything else, when you write a score for a movie, somebody else owns the score. It's not mine. If I'm a writer and I write a story, or if I'm a painter and I paint a painting, the idea of a proprietary copyrighted thing doesn't occur as strictly as it does in music. You write a film score and you develop interesting ideas and you think you'd love to explore that more in your next score or in a serious piece. Like if you're a painter, you could do a whole series of paintings on a theme. But in film music, once you've written it, it belongs to somebody else, and it's a very hard thing to come up with a completely different personality in every film.
Yeah. What are some of his films? His most famous films? I mean, that's that.
Where do you want to start? Aliens,
uh-huh.
An American Tale, Field of Dreams, Apollo 13, Braveheart, Beautiful Mind, Land Before Time, Glory, The Rocketeer, Willow, Jumanji, The Mask of Zorro, Troy, Apocalypto, The Amazing Spider-Man.
Mm.
That's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, yeah.
So for Aliens, there's a particular piece in that soundtrack called Bishop's Countdown. And that's where she has made it to the landing. And Bishop is about there to pick her up. And the alien shows up. And Bishop's ship comes in at the last second. This particular piece is famous for how much it is used in movie trailers.
Mm-hmm.
We talked a bit about movie trailers last time and how important they were and the music that they carry. It's even used a bit in the last moments of Die Hard. It's probably the best soundtrack moment in Die Hard when the very last thing when the terrorist is alive on the ground and pulling out the rifle to shoot John McClane. Then Bishop's Countdown is used in that moment.
And that there's, I can't think of the tune right now, but there's music when Willow and Matt Mardigan are sliding down the mountain on the shield. And that music is used in a lot of trailers, or was.
Yeah.
Of course, you got 2 Academy Awards for Titanic.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Everybody got an award for that.
Yeah.
So in 1979, Paramount came out with Star Trek, the motion picture. Star Trek was a hit, mostly in reruns and syndication. It was a crazy thing how popular it was in the 70s, that and Planet of the Apes, were the thing to play on the playground, along with $6 Million Man.
And the Bionic Woman.
Yes, and the Bionic Woman. Until Star Wars came along in 1977, and everybody strayed towards that. But Paramount wanted a hit like Star Wars. They were, at the time, working on a television show, Star Trek Phase II. They had to replace the Spock character because Leonard Nimoy would not come back. They added Decker and Ilia. And then Star Wars happened, and it was a phenomenon, so they scrapped the Phase II plans and went forward with Star Trek The Motion Picture. Alexander Sandy Courage did that, and he's the composer of the original Star Trek theme. The soundtrack to Star Trek The Motion Picture is magnificent. It's great. It's an excellent movie, but it's remembered as being long and dull. It's not the Star Wars that Paramount wanted. So when they came back to the plate in 1982 for Star Trek II, the movie had much less of a budget. The director had never seen Star Trek.
What?
Yep, Nicholas Meyer, on record as having been not being a Star Trek fan when he was hired to do this. Okay. But he was a fan of making movies, so he sat in the Paramount lot and watched a bunch of old Star Trek episodes. He saw Space Seed and was introduced to the character Khan and thought that would be an excellent movie if one of Kirk's old foes came back. So we got this. And if you look at a lot of Star Trek movies, there's some Romulans and Klingons and space intrigue and politics, but very rarely do you have a character so powerful that they come back in this manner. James Horner for Star Trek II wrote a theme so good that he actually used it twice. There's a movie out there called Battle Beyond the Stars, starring Richard Thomas and George Peppard, and it is eerily similar to Star Trek II. It predates Star Trek II, so not a lot of people know about this flagrant self-ripoff. And it can be easily argued that it's used to much greater effect in Star Trek II.
Battle Beyond the Stars is free on YouTube, by the way.
And deservedly so. Folks, don't pay to see it. But if you love such things, it's worth watching. Apparently, James Horner got his start working with Roger Corman in 1979 on movies like Lady in Red, Humanoids from the Deep, and Battle Beyond the Stars. And he will no doubt later turn up in later episodes of this very podcast.
For sure, for sure.
Unfortunately, James Horner died in June 2015. He was a pilot, very into planes and models and such like that. He was flying alone, so he was the only one. We know that he was flying too low, but we're not sure what happened. He crashed in a national park and died. At the time, he had been working on the soundtrack to the new Magnificent Seven movie, which was a surprise to friends and family. He was keeping that on the down low, but he did score that movie. He demanded to because he loved the first Magnificent Seven so much.
So what did he do? Just walk into the producer's office and
he said, "I'm James
Horner." Pound his fist on the desk.
Similar story for the composing of Star Trek The Motion Picture. As I mentioned before, that was Alexander Sandy Courage. He begged to be in the room while the soundtrack was being recorded and even helped turn pages. He just loved the whole thing that much. He was a Star Trek fan, where Nicholas Meyer was not.
Interesting.
All right, so let's go through some of the tracks. We've got the main title, which is not very surprising. It doesn't stray much. It starts off with the Sandy Courage main theme of Star Trek and diverges a little bit from that with a punchier, more upbeat afterwards. But you definitely know you're sitting in a Star Trek movie when listening to that music.
So in that overture, the main title, of course, is the Star Trek title, right? But then you get that as it builds and builds and builds from the few seconds of the sustained tone, you get fanfare sounds and you get the big Star Trek thing, right? But as it builds and develops a theme, you get this ba-da-ba-ba-ba, 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 ba-da. And it's something that I hear a lot in large orchestral representations of ships. It's a common motive thing that I think that you'll hear in large scores around nautical movements or nautical vessels.
Why do you think Horner put that in?
Because the star of the movie is the Enterprise.
No, I think it's a common trope or theme for nautical themed music, especially anything in like about surrounding a journey or a voyage. So I think it's important.
That's interesting. I did not know that. And Star Trek II is very much a submarine movie.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the intention with the nebula battle between Khan and Kirk.
So, what is this? Do I have the headphones in? So, yeah, so we got this. So it's, so do mi so la so, is that sort of thing. And so it's establishing this as the key, right? And then you get this little, and then you get this. Sometimes you go, it'll go, then back to this. So it's a very common thing that you'll hear in nautical themes.
I also like the kind of whirring strings. It makes me think of just speed flying.
Right.
I can't remember what's over the title. It's just words, right? It's
just not words into the space field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I meant, where it's got a lot of Star Trek themes from Sandy Courage, but it's punched up to be quicker and more exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And a cue to the audience that this is going to be different.
Yeah. So there are three main themes in this piece, right? Three big themes.
Okay.
I mean, there's some other themes, but the three big themes are the Star Trek theme, Spock, and Khan.
Okay.
Okay. So what's the next one that we're going to hear?
Well, if you look at the original release of the soundtrack, they have the tracks out of order, which is, I guess, standard play at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be a little confusing to a kid listening to it, trying to match it up to the movie in his head. The next thing is the surprise attack, where Khan sneaks up in the Reliant on the Enterprise, and Kirk doesn't raise shields until it's too late.
So that's Khan's theme. Right? And then that. I'm not doing it in the right key, but that's the Enterprise theme. So you get both those two themes battling against each other in this score, which of course is in the film itself. But this is the first time that we see the battle between the Enterprise and Voyager.
So, it's awesome to have you guys here and discuss this and break it down on a more technical level. This tension in this scene, and a lot of this movie, if you were to take away the soundtrack, there's no tension.
Right. Yeah, obviously, yeah.
It's an office with people sitting in chairs, kids talking, and God. Buttons being pushed.
Wouldn't you love to see it, though? Wouldn't you love to see, like, 10 minutes of this film with no music, just the dialogue, and then, like, occasional coughs and sounds of chairs squeaking and doors opening and closing and, like, people taking sips of coffee and stuff like that. Like it's just an occasional phone ringing.
It's almost 100% guaranteed that that exists.
I'd love to find that. Yeah.
There is a piece from Jaws, actually, the sea chase scene, with and without soundtrack. And I think it's shown in colleges.
Oh, really?
As they're teaching how important the soundtrack can be, because without that music, that sea chase is nothing.
Oh, yeah.
Without this music here in this particular piece, Khan's theme setting us on edge, grating against our nerves, we've got no tension.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and there's lots of syncopation there in the strings, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially because those ships are moving so slow.
Yeah.
Well, relatively so speaking, they are moving a little bit faster than one would think.
They are at least at half impulse.
The next theme on the docket is called Spock. So this is played when Kirk goes to Spock's quarters. Spock is in deep meditation, and Kirk is there to try to get command of the Enterprise again. And they have that awkward moment where they're like, no, you take it. No, you take it. No, it's yours.
So that opening, that sounds very alien in keeping with Spock's character. And I wonder if that's... That almost sounded like a glass harmonica.
They used synthesizers.
Yes, James Horner is very known for incorporating electronics.
But I was definitely going to say the same thing. Glass harmonica.
Glass harmonica was used in the 19th century sometimes. And I mean, it's essentially water glasses with different levels of water, and they'd rub their fingers around it.
But it's always the same pitches.
But it's that piercing.
How do they get that to their lips?
They play it with their wet fingers.
Oh, and then okay. I wonder if this is intentional, that it incorporates then at the end that boom, 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 the harp. And of course, Mr. Spock plays the Vulcan harp. Mm-hmm. I wish they'd just have Uhura come in and go, and I'm aboard the Enterprise. Mr. Spock is here.
Bitter dregs.
And then if they'd have someone walking down with a guitar down the corridor, going head now to Eden, yeah, brother.
So what you're saying so is many music has always been important.
To yes.
You don't see anybody playing musical instruments in Star Wars, do we?
Yeah, no, there's no music being played in Star Wars ever.
Nope.
Do you know that Nichelle Nichols recorded a disco version of the Star Trek theme with lyrics?
Oh, really?
Maybe I'll open the episode with that.
Do you know why there's lyrics?
Let me think. No.
Gene Roddenberry wrote lyrics to the original theme that they never used, and the reason that he did this is so that he wouldn't have to pay Sandy Courage as much.
Oh!
Because he retained part ownership of the theme to Star Trek.
Tricky bastard.
I know, right? Hollywood shenanigans.
Wow, it's really coming down out there, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, there's Dr. Twitchy Curtains.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I observe all things.
From our spacious studio above the garage.
So next.
Next on the track list is Kirk's Explosive Reply, which is one of my favorites. It starts soft, like a button-pushing moment with just a little bit of tension, and it builds and builds. It's one of those that sneaks in under the action and then becomes everything to what you're seeing.
It incorporates that same Enterprise theme. Mm-hmm. Na, 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 na,
na. Again, as an example of how much work the soundtrack is doing, manipulating the viewer's emotions and excitement levels.
Mm-hmm.
Next up is Khan's Pets. It's a spooky theme where the space slugs burrow into Chekhov's ear, but... in the interest of time, let's skip that one.
Can I ask a question, please? How long did they last on that planet? And if that's all they could rescue, all they could, all the only food or whatever, the only organic creatures that they had, how did they live that long?
Well, you got to remember, you're not talking about humans. You're talking about...
genetically modified human creature. Yeah. Genetically modified what? Superhumans?
Humans.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And don't give me that crap. That's they didn't need any food. They would need more food.
No, I didn't say that. They're physically superior. They're also intellectually superior. They probably thought of a dozen different ways to survive that we did not consider. Well, probably a hydroponics bay.
Based upon fertilized with their own human waste?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. That's all you
should know. They certainly ate those worms, didn't they?
I don't know.
Didn't he refer to them as the only living creatures on that planet?
Well, now.
Oh.
After SETI Alpha 6 destroyed, it shifted.
Oh, they probably had stores and things. Sure. Things that they were able to salvage. Okay, thank you.
Kirk didn't drop him off on that wasteland.
No. Oh, no, Kirk would never do that.
No. So the next up that we can hit is Enterprise Clears Moorings. So this is the scene that in Star Trek The Motion Picture is famous for being... long. Loving the Enterprise just too much and spending. But this theme goes on for over 3 minutes, and it has a similar idea that they are in a shuttlecraft and they're circling Enterprise and they're awestruck at her beauty, and Kirk is just beside himself.
Thank you.
Well, that's exciting to listen to.
It starts off with the lights coming on the disc saucer section of the Enterprise. Mm-hmm. That ba-bum! It moves into probably a nautical theme you may want to talk to, because this harkens back to like the big battleship leaving dock.
Yeah, the budget on brass instruments alone must have been tremendous. It's amazing.
Did you see Star Trek the Motion Picture in the theater?
I did.
I don't know how anyone could complain about the however long it is, 15 minutes of flying past the Enterprise. We'd never seen the Enterprise in such detail.
That's true. Mm. I was distracted because the stupid kid behind me was sticking gum in my hair.
Idiot. Did you have to put ice cube on it to get it out?
I don't remember.
Peanut butter, that's what we used.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You put peanut butter in kids' hair?
No, you put peanut butter in your hair if you have bubble gum in it, because it gets it out. Yeah.
Anyway, it's certainly a little more exciting than the motion picture flyby, music-wise.
Yes.
Faster paced,
yes. That. How long do we have to stare at that stupid cloud in the first Star Trek movie? God. Oh, this giant cloud. Yeah.
I love that movie.
Star Trek the Motion Picture?
Yes, I won't hear a word against it.
Okay.
Directed by Robert Wise, who directed The Sound of Music.
Hmm.
I think you just have a thing for William Decker.
Vija.
I mean, there's that, although he's a pedophile, so that's unfortunate.
Yeah, yeah, he wasn't. Okay. We didn't know about that at the time.
That's not talking about. I don't want to know.
Yeah. So, that was fun, and it was really exciting to listen to. And what was your favorite part of that?
I think the beginning.
Yeah, the bow.
Let's get started here.
I love the fluttering strings as they climb up. I love it. Could you imagine being a string player, being a violinist, and having to read that score? Just like, you'd have to practice. I guess you just get used to the shape of the motives.
Well, yes, string players do famously practice.
No, I'm... Jesus. Just how rapidly those notes move.
There is a piece in Star Trek Into Darkness, a much more recent film, that I'm going to want to talk to you guys about, because I don't know how the string players in that lived and didn't have heart attacks as they were trying to do what they're doing in that soundtrack.
Yeah. Well, that's the sad truth, Chuck. They didn't live.
They died for their art. But I watched them at Wolf Trap recreate it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, nobody dropped off their chair. I was sure that they would.
No, they're used to that sort of thing. Yeah.
The next two pieces are really the meat and potatoes of the movie and the soundtrack itself. The first one being the battle in the Mutari Nebula. So Kirk has gotten off of the asteroid that he was stuck on and back on the ship, and the Enterprise is headed towards the Mutari Nebula to even the odds, where their ship is crippled and Reliant is a bit better off. Kirk has to provoke Reliant to keep following them so they can fight in the nebula.
Before they've even started the battle?
Because they beamed Kirk up.
Yes.
That we thought it would be days before he was able to get back on the Enterprise, but some verbal trickery on Spock's part, it was only hours. Everybody's surprised, and we're reveling in the fact that Kirk is a genius, and he's running down the hallways headed to the bridge where he belongs. So it's a lot of hope, a lot of, okay, we lost everything, we were in a bad spot, and now we have a chance.
In the motives that they use, they he doesn't select to use any minor modes. He uses only major modes in that, which is kind of interesting. And then they go into a big theme, which is doubled. I believe it's a French horn, and then piccolo is doubling. The piccolo is doubling the French horn. Play the same motive, but they're so far apart. It's just this wide, wide, wide gap, which aurally you could perceive as a huge distance between the two instruments as far as where the range that you hear them. I can't remember what's going on, but I'm assuming it's sort of a musical representation of the range between the two ships in the nebula.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So the first part of this piece is them headed towards the nebula, and it's exciting. Khan starts to slow down because he's advised against it from his crew, and Kirk has to taunt him. That's the first time Khan realizes Kirk has escaped. So it works, and Khan doubles his efforts, and then they enter the nebula, and the piece changes to something ethereal.
Well, I mean, the cat and mouse.
This is where the submarine aspect of it really plays in. So the soundtrack is kind of helping us through that, where neither ship can see each other or see each other clearly, and they're kind of groping through this mass in space to find each other. And then all of that kind of ethereal, wisty music coalesces into an exciting, upbeat moment as the Reliant appears on the Enterprise monitors.
Mm-hmm.
And they can see it.
Yeah, but they can't see it very well, just like little blippies of it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Eventually, the piece ends during the battle.
Mm-hmm.
This piece will end, drop off, so that we've got a while without any music. Of phaser blasts and ships blowing up and torpedoes being shot.
Which is music in its own way.
Yeah.
It's visual music, and yeah, it's interesting. I like that we watched it together and we're listening to the score, but we're not looking at the film. And I'm recalling all the elements of the film that I remember.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So then we've had our meat and it's time for the potatoes. The Genesis Countdown is the next piece. So the Reliant is dead in space. Khan has no alternatives. He's probably the only one left alive on the ship. Kirk has sent a signal that they're going to send a boarding party to save any survivors. And Khan doesn't like that, so he activates the Genesis device as a doomsday weapon to kill himself and to hopefully destroy the Enterprise in the process.
Also very hopeful sounding, right from the very beginning. Like they know they're going to win.
Well, he always has.
Right, because he cheats.
Yeah, the start off, it's a countdown. The whole piece is a race the clock on screen and in the soundtrack. And how do you do that with a slow-moving ship? And a lot of work is done in the soundtrack of giving us, keeping us on edge. Will they make it? We know that they're going to make it. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, we do know that they're going to make it, but we don't know the sacrifice that's coming with it.
Right.
With the loss, with the win. Yeah, yeah. Right. The loss that accompanies it. Yeah.
In keeping with the nautical theme, yes, if you have a slow moving ship, you create excitement by creating music for the water, right? Because the water is always moving.
Yeah.
The water in this case being voidless space, but you get the idea.
All the activity on the ship. Yes. Yes, the tension. It does a great job of tension. And the piece ends with Spock.
The piece ends with the explosion.
Okay.
So we know it's coming because we've seen how much radiation Spock has taken, but we don't have that final death scene, which I think is musicless. We do get a little bit of Khan in this when he is quoting Moby Dick and dying, and his eyeball is out and his face is all scarred up, and the rest of the crew is completely missing. There was only one other Khan crewman that had speaking roles, and he's long since dead. But suddenly all the Venice Beach models and bodybuilders they hired for Khan's people, they're all gone.
Are they dead?
They're not on the bridge.
Oh, okay.
We see a dead body here and there, but yeah. Because the only one moving.
Yeah, they're all just standing around in poses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they're cheaper that way.
Yeah. excuse me, director. I was just wondering. I have this costume. I got it from the costumer, and I've got my large hair. Yeah, yes. And I've got this sort of drapey thing here. I've been told just to stand here and look off to the side. I was thinking, I would be very upset being on this bridge, and I'm sure that I could contribute to the scene. Oh, okay. Yes, to the left. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Sorry. Thank you.
Yeah. The Venice Beach models and bodybuilders had quite the accent. So no musical dissecting of that.
No, I mean it's not for me.
Well, no, it's building on that same thing.
He's quoting all the previous themes. Yeah, he's just building and quoting the themes, and the shorter and shorter. You know what's interesting? I have to say something. It occurred to me. One of the things that I said to you at first was the reason I don't really follow movie soundtracks is because the themes change so quickly, and you don't really get a chance to develop them. And I, listening to this from a musical perspective, that criticism that I had doesn't hold up at all. It does get developed. You only get like three or four different themes, and you get to hear them beautifully developed in different contexts throughout the entire score. It's really interesting.
Well, imagine what other surprises this podcast is going to have for you.
But maybe that's what the reason being is that you're not, when you're watching the movie, if the music is well integrated into the action, then you're not going to pay attention
to it. I mean, yeah.
It's part of it's another character, right?
So yeah.
You're not dissecting the music in the moment when you're watching it.
Unless you're a music nerd like me.
Right, obviously.
How fast can I get home and get this playlist?
Do you know if there's a Wilhelm scream in this movie?
There has to be.
I'm sure, I don't know.
Yeah.
So the last item on here. So the movie itself makes us cry when Spock dies and Kirk is separated by the glass wall. We get another sob during the actual funeral when Kirk is delivering the speech and his voice breaks right before they fire Spock off into space and give him a nautical burial. Mm-hmm. But the third and heaviest sob is during the epilogue and end titles, which is so familiar to us because it starts off with the original theme. And the narration, usually performed by Kirk, has always, to this point, been performed by
Kirk.
And this time, it's by Spock.
Space. The final frontier. These are the continuing voyages of the starship Enterprise. Their ongoing mission, to explore strange new worlds. To seek out new life forms and new civilizations. To boldly go where no man has gone before.
They promised him a directing gig. That's why he came back.
Is that true?
Yes.
He
directed 4. They promised him the directing gig. They promised him the death to get him to come to Star Trek 2. To get him to come back for Star Trek 3 and resurrect Spock, they promised him the directing gig for 4. And he directed 4, which was the one most popular with wider audiences.
Well, it's not like he had a really busy career at the time, did he?
He had In Search Of and In Search Of.
Right?
But at the same point, if you're blaming this particular character for killing your career, why would you keep doing it?
Was he blaming that character for killing
his career? I think at certain points in his life, he wrote a book called I Am Not Spock.
Oh, okay.
But he later wrote another book called I Am Spock.
I love that.
So, well, yeah.
Really. I mean, I couldn't tell you all the names of the people on the Supreme Court, but everyone knows who Nichelle Nichols is.
Right.
So there is a certain eternal fame associated with Star Trek, I would argue.
Yeah. Absolutely, and the effect that it had on all of us. I'm fond of telling people any morals I got were from Captain Kirk. My mother tried her hardest to teach me to be a racist, and I knew that was wrong because of Captain Kirk.
But you sleep around a lot.
What?
I learned it from Captain Kirk.
No, I'm a nerd.
I love that.
So, yeah, that's Star Trek II, an amazing soundtrack, in my opinion. One of the best movies ever, whether you like Star Trek or not. Last time we spoke, we talked a lot about modern composers and how they did not do a lot in the soundtracks that we did in the past, like the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I've got a couple of exceptions to that rule that I wanted to drop in your lap. Some favorite modern composers. First off, Christopher Beck. He's famous for doing Frozen. That's a movie I've never seen. Mm-hmm. But my favorite Marvel soundtrack is Ant-Man by Christopher Beck. And we will watch it and we'll listen to it. But it's very plucky and it really emulates insects all through it. So I really enjoy it. So that's one. The second one is Daniel Pemberton. Are you familiar with him?
Mm-mm. No.
He's incredible. He does a lot of stuff that is not traditional instruments. And in one of his soundtracks, he uses breathing. Really, check out his work. I'm sure some upcoming episodes we will showcase him. He did the recent Man from U.N.C.L.E. He did the Birds of Prey movie. King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, was supposed to be a big hit, but wasn't. That's the one where he scores the characters running through Londinium using breathing. It's amazing. And there was an Ocean's 8 movie, a spinoff from Ocean's 11, and Ocean's 8 was all about female con artists, mm-hmm. and he scored that, and it really is amazing. His work is phenomenal. I highly suggest him. Out of all of these, my absolute favorite is Michael Giacchino. And he's done The Incredibles, Doctor Strange, the Jurassic World trilogy, Mission Impossible 3 and Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, the Spider-Man Tom Holland trilogy, but most importantly, the 2009 Star Trek trilogy. The first two soundtracks are amazing, and I couldn't recommend them more if you like this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I do.
Oh, yeah. We'll check those out in future episodes. So, folks, that is all for today. If you've got thoughts you're burning to share with us, Bob will tell you where you can write your missives.
Oh, gosh, I haven't set that up yet. But you can find me on social media at GoGoCheckPod on all your favorite social media platforms. You can find Chuck at AquaDCD on Instagram.
And don't look for me. I don't want to hear from you.
No.
No, I'm not on the socials.
I highly recommend our sister podcast, Dr. Bob and Dr. Husband, take an in-depth look at DC checkerboard-covered comics of the 1960s. It's not only groovy, it's my favorite podcast. Please do the like and subscribe tango and check us out next month as we delve deep into some of your favorite exciting soundtracks. There'll be no Sense and Sensibility here, folks.
Oh, my God.
I promise.
You were digging on that,
what
man.
What about Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters, if they make a movie of that?
I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Sea Monsters. Yeah. But for now, folks, all we have to say is...
The end.